Let me ask you to remember through this weekend the ministry of the Promise Keepers who plan to gather in a large number in Washington, D.C. that will draw some of our own faculty who plan to be there, as well as many of those who have been a part of this student body over the years and are now engaged in ministry. Pray that God will protect in all of those miles of travel and free this particular ministry from any hindrance in their mission to make Christ known and to do so in a way that would glorify him. And let me say also how happy I am to welcome all of you who are a part of the Dallas Day. And you'll be here through this whole day and maybe some time tomorrow as well. And we certainly invite you. You will find a warm welcome among our women and men in the student body, I hope, and they will be willing to answer questions. I'd encourage you to stop someone you don't even know and ask them, just sort of an interview on the street type thing, and ask them about things that you've wondered about. And I think you'll find candor, and I certainly know you'll find sincerity in your answers. It is always such an honor to have both of my predecessors in any of the meetings where I'm a part, and I never want to miss a chance to introduce them to those who may not know these grand gentlemen, theologians, and the real statesmen for Christ. Dr. Walvoord was the president of the school from 1952 to 1986, and Dr. Campbell from 1986 to 1994. Dr. Walvoord is on your left. Dr. Campbell is on your right. I wonder if we just have these two men stand and we express our love for them today. Should we do that? It fit in beautifully with what I want to talk about to have them do that, because I'm on the subject of leadership. Yesterday and today, as all of you know, as we look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 for the guidelines that we want to follow. And in doing so, let me begin by affirming the value of leadership. And certainly when I say that, I have in mind servant leadership, and we're trying to define that carefully, and the emphasis really is more on servanthood than it is on the kind of independent and solo style of leading that we often see around us. But leadership, nevertheless, is essential. It's essential for motivation. It's essential for vision. It is essential for direction. It's essential for morale. I have found over my years on this earth that the single most important ingredient in any organization, regardless of its size, is the kind of leadership that is provided for that organization or for that ministry. Whether it's a small business or a huge corporation, leadership is essential. Whether it's a symphonic orchestra or an athletic team, leadership is vital. It's essential. Whether it's a home and family or a church and its ministry as it grows, leadership is not optional. It's essential for that particular ministry or that church. Whether it's a classroom or the whole school of which the classroom is a part, leadership is essential. Take away leadership and it isn't long before there is a drift. And even the setting up of an aimlessness where objectives get blurred and enthusiasm fades. Ultimately, the whole system grinds to a halt. Peter Drucker's famous lines are as timeless as they are true. If an enterprise fails to perform, we rightly hire not different workers, but a new president. It's a little haunting when I read those words today. I've worked with radio stations for two decades now, and I've observed in a few of those that have deteriorated and lost their mission and goals that it was never the fault of the broadcasters or even the program managers or disc jockeys. Invariably, the problem when there was a failure in a particular radio station, it was the manager, it was the boss, it was the owner that was really at the heart of the problem. Cynthia and I loved to eat at a little romantic restaurant for a number of years, and we would go there for special occasions. There would be anniversaries to celebrate, or one of our birthdays, or we'd take a friend who was enjoying that a particular time in his life or her life, and we would enjoy it often with couples. A candlelit table and china. Women love things like that. Little flowers and little smells. Guys think, what's the food like? And that's usually what guys go for. But women like ambiance and atmosphere. And it was always the restaurant of choice. And a period of time passed when we weren't there, and then we returned after almost a year, and we noticed immediately changes. The place wasn't as kept clean as it had been. There was a turnover in those who served you. The menu was different. It wasn't nearly the class or the touch that it had had in years past. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, we found it wasn't a problem with the waiter or the waitress. It wasn't the guys in the back cleaning the pots and pans. It wasn't the chef. It was the owner. He had lost interest in the restaurant. And you're not surprised, as we weren't, that within a matter of weeks, not even months, the doors of that once wonderful place to enjoy a meal were closed. I've seen the same thing in military outfits, where this particular organization, this group of crack troops that were sharp and disciplined and ready for battle, became sluggish and indolent and sloppy. It wasn't the problem with the infantryman in the field. It was the officer. It was the one who set the stage and set the pace. If I had to limit my definition to leadership to two words, I would use the words inspiring influence. If you are influencing others and you want your influence to be inspiring, you're on your way toward leadership. So that includes mothering and fathering our children. Is there any more important inspiring influence in our lives than our parents? And I'm not referring to commanding or demanding or intimidating kind of influence, but rather a creating of an esprit de corps, almost a cultivation of an atmosphere where people are inspired to change or to follow or to move in another direction or to grow and learn. The classic model of an inspiring leader is Jesus. There will never be one better. I mean, he looked into the faces of a few rugged fishermen who had known only the fishing trade, and he, in one encounter, invited them to leave their work and to follow him. And we read they dropped their nets and they stayed with him those three and a half years. Remarkable. One even left an apparently lucrative tax business and followed him. He stands alongside a woman of Samaria. Within a brief period of time, after a dialogue recorded in John 4, she goes back and we read many of the Samaritans believed in him. She couldn't stop talking about this encounter, this man who told her everything about herself, much of which she thought was absolutely secret. When Thomas doubted and said he would not believe All it took was the inspiring leader to show him his hands and his side. And he burst forth, "My Lord, my God." I don't believe he even reached out and touched the scars. All it took was the inspiring presence of the Lord Christ. In the Thessalonian letter, the apostle is recalling his leadership among those people of ancient Macedonia and Greece. And he even makes the statement, which is a marvelous recollection, verse 1 of chapter 2, "Our coming wasn't in vain." And as we learned yesterday, it's not the word for unproductive, it's the word for hollow or without purpose. As I look back over my shoulder and remember those weeks I was with you, I recall it was not a purposeless time. We didn't sort of wander about hoping we would reach some objectives. God was in it. In fact, he says several times, "as you know," verse 2. Verse 5, "as you know," "as you know." He says it again in 9, again 10, again 11. You remember these things. We didn't lead incorrectly. Now, yesterday we talked about the wrong kind of leadership, the kind of leadership that nobody wants to follow. It's marked by verse 3, deception. Verse 5, flattery. Verse 5, greed. And again, verse 6, some kind of autocratic or authoritarianism. Sometime when I dig into the text, I like to linger over words that could be passed over quickly. For example, this little contrastive particle, "but," in verse 7, which changes the whole scene. Dane and Manty say that it is a strong adversative conjunction, often emphatic. "On the contrary, but instead," says the apostle, "we did not do these things, but instead we did this." Our leadership was marked by that. He is getting ready to introduce a remarkable antithesis. He just said in verse 6, "We could have asserted our authority as apostles of Christ, but we didn't do that. We came as a nursing mother that tenderly cares for her children." Look at that. In fact, the authority, dunamis in verse 6, is met with the simple word used only here and in 2 Timothy 2:24, where the apostle says to Timothy, the pastor, the minister is not to be one of argumentativeness, but rather kind. It's the way it's rendered over there in 2 Timothy 2:24. Here it's handled as gentle. Gentle. In fact, I love the analogy. We proved to be gentle. Really, the word is became. We became gentle among you. And it was as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. That's great wording. It's a wonderful analogy. If you want to have the first of four qualities I want to suggest from this passage that will really be a leadership style anyone would admire, start with a sensitivity to needs. We became gentle. Former President George Bush called for our nation to become a kinder, gentler nation. I always liked the way that sounded. I don't know that it happened. I know he had it as a dream, a desire. I would wish it so. I would suggest that you make it your aim in your training for ministry that you press toward a kinder and gentler style. You come from a school that is known for its convictions and at times even its dogmatism. And there's nothing wrong with either one handled appropriately. But it's wonderfully disarming when they find a Dallas grad who was also kind and gentle. In fact, I kind of warm up to grads like that. So this is a good place to get into practice. Be gentle with your profs. It's a little, no extra charge for this little application here. These are mere women and men. These are mere human beings, and you know that. Highly admired, well-trained, deeply entrenched in their disciplines, but gentleness is a lovely, lovely thing. It's a good place to learn it. If you're not gentle here, trust me, you're not going to be gentle there. If this great apostle could have thrown his weight around but deliberately didn't, but became gentle among them, we can do that by the Spirit of God's power and enablement. We prove to be gentle among you. Look at this. As a nursing mother tenderly cares. It's an old word here, thalpo. It's an old word for warming. Isn't that interesting? It's for a mother or a nurse holding and warming a little infant. I could just feel my little tiny babies in our arms, our little grandchildren. When they were born, I remember holding them. I remember the first time I held one of our own. It was, of course, our firstborn, and little curly-headed, naked little creature. They had cleaned all the cheese off of him and got him all ready, and they gave him to me, and I just kind of reached out, and his head fell back. And I remember I'd never held a baby, and I said, "Hold your head up." And my wife says, "No, honey, that's not the way you do it. You have to hold your hand under their head, because you got to be tender with them, honey." And here I was, you know, I'm loud anyway. And when we'd bring our babies home, they'd spend 2 weeks crying because I'm so loud. And I'd come in, "Sweetheart," you know, I'd just blow them away. No, you got to speak. You got to speak carefully. You got to speak tenderly. Like a nursing mother tenderly cares for the little babies. There's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right about it. And I mean that if you are the most dynamic, significant individual in the community as a minister of the gospel, have a heart. Be gentle. Be real gentle when they come broken and bruised. Repentant. Be real gentle with them. There's a tenderness here that deserves a pause. And if that isn't enough, he adds a second, having thus a fond affection for you. So let's add, along with sensitivity to needs, let's include affection for people. Let's add that one, because Paul is a good model. That's a good leadership quality, having a fond affection for you. Milligan suggests that this term, fond affection, he calls it language from the nursery. Isn't that a great line? Language from the nursery. You're dealing with newborns often, and they don't know their way around. Give them a break. It'll be your tendency when you get out of here, you got your stuff up all the way to your ears, and you got truckloads of things. And you know, you're ready to back up. Dong, 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 you back up, and all this stuff comes out. And it comes all over them. And they're just trying to find Genesis. You know, they're just trying to locate chapter and verse. Have a heart with them. Treat them carefully. They'll love you. And more importantly, they'll love your God so much more easily when they learn to love you. And so this affection for people is so important. We're not falling in love with the biblical text here. We're learning to fall in love with God's people
And this biblical text just gives us help in the food we provide as we feed them and as we feed ourselves. Having a fond affection for you. Look at this. Boy, you talk about a winning combination. We were pleased to impart to you not only the gospel, but also our own lives. Why, Paul? Because you became very dear to us. He loved those people. Isn't the gospel sufficient? Absolutely. Well, then isn't just the delivery of the gospel enough? Absolutely not. It isn't enough. The delivery of the pure gospel along with an authentic life. See, he says, we gave you not only the gospel, but we gave you our very lives. He didn't minister to them for what he would get out of it. He ministered to them to pour himself into their lives. The transferring of truth included the unfolding of his very life. He wasn't hiding out, inaccessible, untouchable. He said, you became dear to us. When people become dear to you, there isn't a guarding. There isn't a resistance. At times, you'll put your arms around them and you'll hug them. I've had adult men say to me, in my adult life, you're the first adult arms I ever remember wrapping around me. That is remarkable. As a minister, as a missionary, as a person who cares about people, go ahead. Reach on out there. I watched a great thing yesterday over by the cafeteria. We had finished our meal, Johnny Coons and I, and we were walking out. Mark Young was walking. I don't know if Mark's here or not, but Mark was walking out with one of his Polish friends. And he had, this individual had come over to visit with him, he was introducing his friend to Johnny and me, and I said, hey, why don't you guys just talk a little Polish? I'd like to hear that. I just like to check up, make sure Mark really knew his stuff. So I said, go ahead. Boy, did he ever. And it wasn't long before the face of this friend that had come from over in Europe just lit up as he heard his language. And more importantly, he saw in Mark's face an affection and a love. And before long, they were just all over each other. And I thought, that didn't just happen this noon. That relationship has been cultivated over years. And there was a fond affection in Mark's heart for that friend of another language and another culture, but they linked. It was wonderful to watch it. I love to watch pastors minister to their flocks when there's not a sermon going on. The apostle was a wonderful model of that. He said, you were dear to us. You recall our labor and our hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. Wonderful. He said, I kept up my work on the side. I didn't come to fleece the flock. I came to, I had to earn a living, and along with that, I was able to minister. You know what I sense in all this? I sense that Paul probably felt a need for them, too. You know, this guy is no solitary statue. He needed people. It was a wonderful combination. Wall Street Journal several years ago included a piece put together by United Technology Company. Listen to these words. It's how important are you? Well, more than you think. A rooster minus a hen equals no baby chicks. Kellogg minus a farmer equals no cornflakes. If the nail factory closes, what good is a hammer factory? Paderewski's genius wouldn't have amounted to much if the piano tuner hadn't shown up. Isn't that a good line? The cracker maker does better if there's a cheese maker.
The most skillful surgeon needs the ambulance driver to deliver the patient. Just as Rogers needed Hammerstein, you need someone and someone needs you. You're learning at seminary, aren't you, the value of community? You are learning, aren't you, that isolation is lethal. Keep reaching out. Keep touching. Stay vulnerable. Which brings us to this third authenticity of life. Sensitivity to needs, affection for people, and now the end of verse 8, authenticity of life. You had become very dear to us. And verse 9, we didn't want to be a burden to you as we proclaim the gospel. Now 10, you are witnesses. See, he's calling to mind those weeks they were together. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamely we behaved toward you believers. He's not bragging. He's vulnerable. He says, you remember that. I was what I was. Remember, he's imparting his whole life. Which brings me to a very important moment. There will be times in ministry when your heart will be broken and you simply cannot hold back the tears. And my counsel to you is don't. I mean, you laugh freely and you speak with firm conviction, certainly, then don't miss the tears. Because you will discover over the years that those tears will endear you. Talk about terms of endearment. They will endear you to the folks that you're ministering alongside of. Reminds me of a great speech delivered back at February 12, 1959. On the 150th anniversary of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, by the distinguished poet and historian Carl Sandburg, one of the treasured works in my library is a four-volume work of Sandburg as he writes on Lincoln in the war years. Very wonderful accounts of scenes of Lincoln's life. Anyway, he came to Washington, D.C. to speak before a joint session of Congress. And he entitled his talk on Lincoln, Man of Steel and Velvet. Just an excerpt from it. Sandburg said, not often in the story of mankind does one arrive on earth who is both steel and velvet, who is hard as rock and soft as drifting fog, who holds in his heart and mind the paradox of terrible storm and peace unspeakable. While the war winds howled, he insisted, the Mississippi was one river meant to belong to one country. While the war wavered and broke and came again as generals failed and campaigns were lost, he held enough forces together to raise new armies and supply them until generals were found who would make war as victorious war has always been made, with terror, frightfulness, destruction. Valor and sacrifice past words of man to tell. And then this line. In the mixed shame and blame of the immense wrongs of two crashing civilizations, often with nothing to say, Lincoln said nothing, slept not at all, and on occasion was seen to weep in a way that made weeping appropriate, decent, and majestic. There's a leader I want to follow. When your heart breaks, let it break. When Jesus stood beside the tomb of his friend Lazarus and saw all the rampant unbelief around him, he wept. And in a few moments' time, Lazarus, come forth! With all the strength of deity, he called the dead
back in resuscitated form. Steel, velvet. You got to have both. Now there's one more. Sensitivity to needs, affection for people, authenticity of life, enthusiastic in affirmation. Look at verse 11. Just as you know how we were exhorting, encouraging, and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. I can smile because we got great bookends here. We got a mother in verse 7, and we got a dad in verse 11. What a great wraparound for a family concept, huh? The tenderness of a mother and the affirmation of a father. I don't know if you've sat around the father of a ball player on the field, but you haven't lived until you've been near one. We figured out about 17 years in high school stadiums with our four kids that went through, cheerleaders and ball players and all that. And one of those segments of time, the quarterback's father, Dan Quello, sat right behind us. We always sat in the same seats. We'd always bring the chicken for the cheerleaders because we had a cheerleader out there all those years, and we'd deliver the chicken. Then we'd go up and sit in our seats, and Dan and I would have the greatest time. But Dan, two of those years, Dan's son was a quarterback. Dan changed during those 2 years. It was unbelievable. I mean, there were times we were kind of sitting there, and Dan was on his feet. Go after it! Stop! Don't do that! And I thought, Dan, get a life. Good night. He said, call play 14-9-7, red, zip, zap, whatever the play was. And Dan, sit down. I mean, what's he doing? He's saying to his son. One time his son looked up there and said, be quiet. I mean, his dad is up there just pulling for him, pulling for him, pulling for him. That's the way dads are. They just kind of lose it. That's the scene right here in verse 11. You know how we are exhorting and encouraging and imploring you. That's the role of a leader. You can do it. We're not going to quit. It's tough. It's hard. This is a difficult valley our seminary is going through. We're not giving up. We're not stopping. We're pressing on. God didn't call me here to watch the liquidation of Dallas Seminary. This is a place where God is at work. Sovereignly in charge, watching over, guarding, and guiding. And it is our responsibility to take up the torch and carry it. That's what we're about. It's like a father would his own children. Why? So that you may walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you. That's what it's all about. If you get all this stuff together and fail to walk in a manner worthy, you missed it. And so have I. One final thought, and I'm through. Be real careful in your drive for excellence and your pursuit of your academic ideals. And I applaud each one. And hold them high. Do your very best. But be careful about neglecting your walk. Be careful. That's what Dan has talked about for our day of prayer next Tuesday. I read your mind. You're thinking, well, see, I got to go to two of those meetings. See, I can, if I come late to one, that's one. And if I leave early in another, that'd be two. You know, I can't, you know, that's two. What kind of thinking is that? We are here to cultivate a walk with God. We just can't legislate it. We just have to provide the opportunity for you. In my travels, I've had the pleasure of meeting Howard Rutledge, remarkable officer in the United States Air Force. He was a pilot and a good one. While flying another of many missions over Vietnam, he was shot down. And he endured years at the hands of his cruel captors in a Viet Cong prison called Heartbreak.
He captured his story in a book entitled, In the Presence of Mine Enemies. Among his lines, during those longer periods of enforced reflection, it became so much easier to separate the important from the trivial, the worthwhile from the waste. I had been too busy, too preoccupied to spend one or two short hours a week thinking about really important things. Now the sights and sounds and smells of death were all around me. My hunger for spiritual food soon outdid my hunger for a steak. Now at last, I wanted to know about that part of me that will never die. Now I wanted to know about God and Christ and the church. But in heartbreak, solitary confinement, there was no pastor, no Sunday school teacher, no Bible, no hymn book, no community of believers to guide and sustain me. I had completely neglected the spiritual dimension of my life. It took prison to show me how empty life is without God. Watch that as you are in training to be God's servant leader in your ministry. Let's bow together.